Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, America's National Intelligence Chief says North Korea is unlikely to give up all of its nuclear weapons. The statement contradicts President Donald Trump's claim of progress on denuclearization. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats spoke to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday. He said, "We currently assess that North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities and is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons and production capability because its leaders ultimately view nuclear weapons as critical to regime survival." Trump and Kim met in Singapore last June. The two promised to work toward the complete denuclearization of the divided Korean Peninsula. But progress has been limited. The U.S. has demanded full information from North Korea about its nuclear and missile sites. North Korea is seeking an end to economic restrictions against it. The government also wants a peace treaty to officially end the Korean War. Trump is planning a second meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in February. Trump met with North Korea's nuclear issues negotiator Kim Yong-chol on January 18th. He said afterwards that the two sides had made a lot of progress on denuclearization. Coates met with the Senate to present the yearly Worldwide Threat Assessment of the U.S. Intelligence Committee. U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Director Gina Haspel and Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Christopher Wray were also there. Coates told the committee that Iran is not currently undertaking the key nuclear weapons development activities. Iran had agreed to give up its nuclear activities in exchange for trade and investment from the West. Last year, Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal negotiated earlier under President Barack Obama. Trump called it the worst deal ever. And Iran is threatening to build up its nuclear activities if the country does not gain from the promised trade and investment. The report also said the Islamic State group remains a terrorist and insurgent threat inside Iraq. The terrorist group also operated in Syria, where Trump has ordered a full withdrawal of American troops.
Environmental experts warn that our planet is drowning in plastic. The world's cities produce 2 billion tons of trash every year. By the year 2050, that number is expected to rise to 3 billion tons. The World Bank estimates that the largest amount of trash today, about 44%, is plastic. This information comes from a 2018 World Bank report called Trends in Solid Waste Management. But we often have to buy packaged goods, and often that packaging is made of plastic. Now that may be changing. A new environmentally friendly shopping model was recently launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. This shopping model, called Loop, aims to replace throwaway containers with reusable ones. This is part of what some people call the zero waste movement. The main belief driving this movement is that much of the trash we create is unnecessary. Loop is the idea of TerraCycle, an American-based recycling company. Its chief, Tom Zaki, told the Associated Press that removing plastics from the ocean is not enough. He said the point is to get away from disposability and single-use packages. Zaski said that Loop is the future of shopping, but it comes from an idea of the past. He likened it to the milkman model of the 1950s in the United States. Back then, someone brought milk to your doorstep in glass bottles and then left with empty bottles. These could be cleaned and used again. The result is zero waste. Loop will work the same way. Instead of throwing away or recycling a container, the product comes in a reusable one. When the product is all gone, someone will collect and clean the old container, fill it up, and then return it to you. At the start, Loop will offer about 300 products. Many of these include products that Americans use every day, and they come from some of the biggest names in business: Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo, Nestle, and Coca-Cola, just to name a few. Procter & Gamble makes many personal and healthcare products, such as soap, deodorants, and diapers for babies. The company's vice president and chief sustainability officer is Virginie Helias. She told the AP that the goal of Procter & Gamble is to use all reusable or recyclable packaging by 2030. Helias said that selling products on Loop is risky because no one else has tried it. She explained that Procter & Gamble will start by selling 10 products on Loop as a test. If the results are good, more products will be added later. Representatives from the environmental nonprofit organization Greenpeace also joined in the discussion about Loop at Davos. Jennifer Morgan is the group's international executive director. She said that Greenpeace welcomes the aim of the Loop Alliance to move away from throwaway culture and disposability. But Morgan questioned whether companies worldwide are ready to change their business models. I'm Ana Mateo.
It is common for adults to use baby talk when interacting with very young children. This way of speaking attempts to copy the sounds babies make when they first try to talk. But is this form of communication helpful to a child's development? Several studies have suggested a clear link between parental language methods and a child's early language development. Studies showed that language learning in babies was improved when parents spoke more than a few simple words and used a wider vocabulary. Earlier research found that the style of speech used by parents to communicate with their baby could increase language development. One such speaking style is known as parentese. Research has shown that babies react better to this kind of language in the first months of life. Generally, parentese involves adults speaking in a higher voice and at a slower speed. The language is simplified while sentences are short and often repeated. Studies from the past 30 years have confirmed that babies spoken to in parentese developed larger vocabularies throughout the first 3 years of life. A new study on the subject examined whether parents can be effectively taught methods to improve their parentese skills. The study was a project of the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. Patricia Kuhl is a professor of speech and hearing sciences and serves as co-director of the institute. She says the goal of the study was to find out whether a parent can be coached to create their own speaking style to improve language learning in children. Naya Ferian Ramirez helped lead the study. She also is with the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. She said that the parents involved in the research were first shown the importance of language input for their baby's development. Parents were then given suggestions on how to use different parentese methods. They were then rated on how well they used these methods with their child. Most parents know that the amount of language their child hears is important, Ferian Ramirez said. What we shared with them through coaching is that how they talk to their baby may matter even more. She added that the new study is important because there are still a lot of parents with little knowledge about how to use parentese to help their child. This was one reason the researchers included parents from different cultural and economic groupings, she said. For the experiment, parents were given a small recording device, which they placed inside a piece of their baby's clothing. All spoken communication from parents and child were recorded during a whole weekend as the family took part in normal activities. The recordings were made at three different periods of the child's life, when the youngster was 6, 10, and 14 months old. The parents were divided into two groups, a control group and an intervention group. Those in the intervention group received coaching after their 6th and 10th month recordings. Ferian Ramirez said the parents who received coaching greatly increased the amount and effectiveness of parentese than the other parents. But the most exciting finding was that babies of parents who received coaching showed better language skills at 14 months, she added. The study found that between the ages of 6 and 14 months, coached parents increased the amount of speech directed to the child and their use of parentese by 15%. Parents in the control group showed less growth in those areas, about 7%. To measure a baby's language skills, the team measured levels of what the researchers describe as babbling. Babbling can sometimes include actual words if they can be clearly recognizable as such. Ferian Ramirez said increases in babbling are likely to lead to long-term improvements in child development. This is important because we know that early language skills are important predictors of later language and of children's ability to learn to read and succeed in school, she said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, it is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said, "and only that." He continued, "I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled. This Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended."
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. A doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2nd, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.